talk show hosts across the country love Doris Kearns Goodwin, the presidential historian and author, because she's such a great guest. She'll be coming to Kansas City this weekend under the auspices of the Truman Library Institute to talk about leadership lessons from the White House. In fact, she'll be speaking on Saturday evening with Bill Moyers. More on that in just a few minutes. She's had one of those killer careers. She worked for Lyndon Johnson. She's won a Pulitzer for her book, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, the Home Front During World War II. She's written about the Kennedys, about Lincoln. Her most recent book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. And Doris Kearns Goodwin, welcome back to Up to Date. So good to have you again.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you again, too. Thank you.
Well, you're also known as a baseball fanatic, a Red Sox fan, and now, at least for many of us out here, Doris, we know what it's like to finally win a World Series. What a thrill this has been.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, it just is something that cuts across all sorts of lines when your own community wins and you walk around the streets and you feel connected to everybody.
Yeah.
It's a magical experience. So I was thinking about all you guys and just, you know, in my mind, thinking and picturing what it felt like, because it was so extraordinary for us since 1918 when it first happened in 04.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then in 07. But then we were actually at the game when we won that marathon year, and that was the first time ever to be at the game when it won. And it's just a memory you'll never forget. So I'm sure you guys have it, and I'm glad for you.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I mean, can you be a rabid baseball fan when your team is losing and losing a lot?
It was really hard. I mean, I think what happened in the early days before, you know, they finally won, the Red Sox, they would come so close. So at least you had most of the summer to be happy. In fact, now that I'm older, that's all I ask anymore. I would rather have a good record in the summer, and I don't care if we lost in the first playoff game, but at least most of the summer I'd be happy. What's been hard for us here is that we've been so bad now, you know, that you can't, it's hard to really keep that spirit going when you're losing day after day. And then I don't even want to read the newspapers because I don't want to see the scores. And then I don't know what's happening in the world. And then I go on Meet the Press and I sound stupid. So it's a very bad thing. It connects to everything.
You can just blame it all on the Red Sox, right?
I can blame it all on the Red Sox.
Well, you're coming out here to talk about leadership and what we've learned about leadership after more than two centuries of the American experiment through the office of the presidency. There are lots of lessons, I'm sure. What's the first thing about leadership you would tell an incoming president to think about as he or she prepares to take over?
You know, I'm not even sure if there's a first thing, but I think, you know, one of the most important things is for a president to surround himself or herself with people of different temperaments so that no president comes in with all the strengths that you need to lead. I mean, some are good in dealing with Congress one-on-one. Some are great communicators. Some are decisive. Others are inspirational. You need to then know what are your strengths and who am I going to put around me that'll help fill out those. It's not so much only like Lincoln's team of rivals. It's something even deeper than that. It's really knowing not just different factions that should be around you, but different people that can give you the kinds of characterological or temperamental possibilities that you may not have.
You know, every once in a while, you know, a political guy like me reads about a president gathering historians for an evening just to talk about history. President Obama has done that. In fact, you attended at least one of those salons back in 2009. What happens in a meeting like that?
Well, it's really been fun. In fact, I've been at all of them except one and had talked with President Obama right at the beginning about his desire to set this up. So we come in, you know, with our presidents in our head. We're not dressed up, you know, like Truman or Jefferson or Jackson or whatever. But then we talk about current issues, which may be dealing with Congress at that point or some communication issue, and then try and figure out what can these people tell him. How did they experience something like this and how did they deal with it? Telling stories, for example, in communicating, or figuring out how to get through a rough patch with Congress and how LBJ did that. And it's just been fun. And he has China out that's particularly presidential China. So I think all of us have felt really lucky to be part of it.
Do you get a chance to walk through the White House? Again, obviously you have spent time there during your time with Lyndon Johnson, but that must be a kick for a presidential historian to be in that home one more time.
Without a question. I don't care how many times you go to the White House, it's still a thrill. And for me especially, I think it's true when I went back there after years of not having been there, you know, to be able to see the place where my office was, to see the little room right next to the Oval Office, which is where I used to sit with LBJ at night when he wanted to talk about what had happened that day. And, you know, just see the couch. It may not be the same couch. And, of course, see the Oval Office. You know, no matter what, even just standing in front of the White House, I just get this feeling of a thrill about how simple and beautiful it is compared to some of the bigger palaces in Europe that house the government officials. It's just a great place.
Is there a place or two, you've mentioned a couple here, but a couple of other places inside that building that really sort of light you up, Doris, as a presidential historian?
Well, I think, you know, the most important thing that happened to me was that when I was writing FDR and Eleanor, I kept imagining, because FDR had a whole bunch of people living in the White House on the second floor. He had his foreign policy advisor, Harry Hopkins, who came for dinner one night, slept over, his secretary, the princess from Norway, Winston Churchill, Eleanor's great friend, Lorena. And I kept picturing them in their bathrobes at night and what it must have been like to have listening to the conversations as they were on the second floor corridor. So it happened that I mentioned this on a radio program in Washington when the FDR book came out, and Hillary was listening, Hillary Clinton. So she called me up the radio station, invited me to sleep overnight in the White House. So then we could then wander the corridor together and figure out where everyone had slept. So that for me was incredible. I brought my map in hand and we figured out, yes, Harry Hopkins had slept where Chelsea Clinton was. Bill Clinton was sleeping where FDR was. And we were in Winston Churchill's bedroom. So there was no way I could sleep. I was certain he was drinking his brandy and smoking his cigar. So being up on that second floor again, which I had been with LBJ, but I didn't think of asking when I was 24, where did FDR sleep? Where was Eleanor? So that was really exciting.
We're visiting with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. You know, you mentioned, Doris, a few minutes ago and just again there about your time visiting with Lyndon Johnson during the final years of his presidency. You were a young woman back in those days, and I'm wondering, what was it like for you to be sitting inside, just next door to the Oval Office, talking to the leader of the free world about the big issues facing him at that time, just hearing him out? What was that like for you?
You know, I look at it sometimes now and think, oh, my God, if I knew then what I know now, if I knew I was going to become a presidential historian, that I would have had so many questions to ask him. But at the time, you know, you're young, you're keeping him company. I realized it was special. It's not that I didn't know that. But maybe partly because I wasn't yet, you know, developed into an historian, he could be more open with me. He was at that time in his life. I'm more sad about what the war had done to cut his legacy in two. So he was able to spend more time talking to me than if I'd known him at the height of his power. If I'd been there in 1965 when everything is passing, he's not going to have time to sit down with a young girl at the end of the day. But I'm so grateful for it, because there's no question that I think it fired within me the drive to understand the inner person behind the public figure, to look empathetically at my subjects, as I've tried to do ever since that experience with him, because I started out so critical of him and ended up really trying to understand him, even if the war in Vietnam still remained a scar on his legacy.
Would you tell us that story again about how what you wrote about President Johnson that so angered him, and yet you were able to overcome it and develop this relationship with him and become an historian as a result? You almost didn't have this opportunity.
No, even more than I knew, I almost didn't. There was just the 50th anniversary of the White House Fellows Program, and Tom Johnson, who was in that first program, was with LBJ when he discovered this article that I had written. What happened is I was in graduate school at Harvard when I was selected as a White House Fellow and very active in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and had written an article with a friend of mine about a third-party candidate challenging Lyndon Johnson. I mean, it was rather idealistic. It was going to be African-Americans, poor people, anti-war people, women, everybody somehow coming in against the two-party system. And it was sent to the New Republic. We never heard anything. We had a big dance at the White House. I was selected as a White House Fellow. He did dance with me. And then a few days later comes this article published, and its title was How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power. So I would certainly kick me out of the program. And in fact, Tom Johnson told me they were afraid on Air Force One to show him the article. And they thought, oh my God, he might not only kick me out, but maybe he'd undo the entire program because it was a young program. But instead, surprisingly, he said, oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can. So I did end up. I didn't get assigned to him directly, though. I was too lethal for that, I think. But then once he pulled out of the race in 68 in March, he called me up at Willard Wirtz's office, which is where I was working in the Labor Department as a White House fellow. He said, all right, you said I should be thrown out of office. Now you have to work for me for the rest of your White House fellowship. And then he kept me on the White House staff until he left. And then I went down to the ranch and helped him on his memoirs. So it really was the beginning of this fascination with presidents. How a weird way to have it start.
Did you become a fan of his over time?
Without a question. I mean, there's no question. He's one of the most interesting, and he was totally committed to the domestic legislation. In fact, I'm so glad to see that in these 50th year anniversaries of the Civil Rights Bill, the Voting Rights Bill, aid to education, Medicare, Medicaid, immigration reform, he's finally getting his domestic due. I mean, nobody was better able at dealing with the Congress than he was. And it's not just that he had a majority when he won in 64. He knew how to keep the legislation moving, not to settle for one thing. And he knew how to call these guys up in the morning, at night. I mean, I can't wait to be with Bill Moyers. Hopefully we can talk about Lyndon Johnson because he knew him better than I did even. He was there in a longer period of time, and I think he's such a great guy. So this is going to be fun.
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin will be speaking with Bill Moyers at 6 on Saturday evening at Unity Temple on the Plazas, part of an event sponsored by the Truman Library Institute. General admission is sold out, but there still may be tickets available for Truman Library Institute members. More information, go to TrumanLibraryInstitute.org. It'll be a terrific evening with two presidential history heavyweights, Doris Kearns Goodwin and Bill Moyers. You know, I can't help but think of, you know, both you and Bill, you know, as you think and reflect back on your old boss, Lyndon Johnson, and the extraordinary promise of that administration, and then seeing Vietnam so brutally undermine it. I'm wondering how often you've thought back to that you'd, you know, like to crawl back into history somehow, Doris, and scream at Lyndon Johnson to get the heck out of Southeast Asia shortly after he assumed the presidency.
Oh, I think about it so often. You know, when you listen to the LBJ tapes, you hear him saying early on, you know, shortly after Kennedy's death and in 64, what are we doing over there anyway? Why are we there? We shouldn't be doing this. And then somehow the recommendations come that if you don't escalate a little more the numbers of people there, if you don't send some more soldiers, it's going to fall. And if it falls, then the dominoes fall and you'll have lost an entire region, much less a country. And then that gradual escalation that got deeper and deeper. And it wasn't where his heart was, but he bears responsibility, obviously, for making those decisions. He had all of Kennedy's advisors there. If only somehow, I think maybe he would have been better off making his own advisors. Mm. And then he would have felt more confident. I think it was just that sense of not feeling confident about foreign policy the way he did about domestic policy. But I think he would have been as great as FDR domestically if he hadn't had that war cut everything in half.
But he kept Kennedy's advisors because he wanted to offer the country a sense of continuity after the Kennedy assassination, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's hard to remember back to that period of time. We now know that, you know, he was not part necessarily in the assassination of an entire world conspiracy against JFK and against America. But at the time, there was a feeling this could be Russia, it could be China, and the country was pretty shaken by it. And I think he did think that people didn't trust necessarily him. They didn't know a lot about him. They thought he came from Texas, which he did, where the murder took place, then where the murder of the murderer took place.
Yeah.
So by keeping the Kennedy cabinet there, it was exactly, as you say, a feeling of continuity and getting people through the crisis. But it turned out probably not to be the right thing for him.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is my guest. You know, in those private conversations you would have with him late in the evening, just off the Oval Office there, Doris, how remorseful, how regretful was he about Vietnam? What would he say in those private moments?
Well, I think it was hard for him ever to acknowledge that it had been a mistake to go in there because he bore responsibility for the lives that were lost. And so I think that's where presidents have a hard time when they know I sent them in there for a mission. The mission was thought to be important. It didn't turn out the way we hoped it would. And finally, the bombing halt comes, and finally it begins to go down after many years. But what he did understand was that his domestic policy progress, he said when he first did the first Great Society programs on education or poverty, you were just learning how to crawl, and then you learned how to walk, and then eventually you'd run. And he knew that those programs could be get made better, and the mistakes could be figured out, and that they really could change the social landscape of the country. And indeed, many of them did, without a question, civil rights and voting rights and Medicare. But it could have been so much more fully developed, and he knew the war had cut that in two. So there was a terrible sadness before he died, knowing that. I just wish he had been alive to see at least everything else he did as being appreciated today in a way that it wasn't even 10 or 20 years ago because the war's shadow was so great.
You know, I guess you could argue that in the 50 years since, the country has not been in that same position politically to evolve and change as it was back in the mid-1960s.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary period. You realize that now, looking back as an historian, there are certain decades when there's a social ferment in the country at large, and it helps to push the change from the bottom up. You know, it certainly happened with the anti-slavery movement, you know, in the 1850s leading up to the birth of the Republican Party and Lincoln. It happened at the turn of the 20th century with the progressive movement leading up to Teddy Roosevelt and the Square Deal legislation. It obviously happened in the 1930s and 1940s with the Depression and then World War II. And then it happened again in the 60s, and with a combination, I think, of the civil rights movement, of young people, you know, getting involved in the Peace Corps and the Teacher Corps, and beginnings of the women's movement. There was just a lot of ferment, and those decades were so much fun to live in. It all ended up in a very different way. That's part of what was lost because of Vietnam. You know, those positive change moments turned into anti-war demonstrations and into, you know, people getting arrested, and that whole energy was necessarily anti because people felt the war was wrong, but it wasn't as constructive in a way as the earlier ones were for civil rights or poverty.
Let's have some fun here and change direction here just a little bit, Doris. If you could gather three presidents for dinner tonight, who would they be, and what would you like to talk to them about? Where would that conversation go?
Well, no matter who would have asked me that question if I were in the middle of writing about one of the people, it would have to be that person. I'd want them there that night, and I'd feel like I was betraying them. But now I'm working on a new book on leadership, and so it's going, instead of studying, you know, a whole new president like George Washington or something, I'm just taking Lincoln, FDR, Teddy, Roosevelt, and LBJ, and trying to figure out where their ambition came from and when they identified as leaders and how they slept at night. So I always used to say, if I had dinner with Lincoln, instead of asking him the important historian's question, what would you have done differently about Reconstruction, I would have just asked him at dinner to tell me a story. Because when he told stories, his whole face changed, his laughter would come out, and he would come alive. But now I think, given what I've been working on in this leadership book, I'd like to talk about their younger years even and figure out what made them think about that they could become a leader. When did they first think of themselves that way? You know, how did they learn to speak in public? What mistakes did they make? How did they get through their toughest times? All those questions about leadership. How much do they think they were born with? What traits and how much were developed over time? Oh, I'd give anything to have these guys together and dinner right now more than ever.
You know, I'm always struck hearing you talk about these people. You know, when you focus on one president or a couple presidents, as you did in your latest book with Roosevelt and Taft, you know, you spend so much time with them. It's almost like you develop this relationship with them. There's an intimacy that I sense as you describe the incredible amounts of time you spend with these people, even if it's not face-to-face.
No, you really do feel that way. I mean, if it's 7 years working on Teddy and Taft, or 10 with Lincoln, 6 with Franklin and Eleanor, every day you're thinking about these people as you wake up. You're thinking about them at night when you go to bed. So you do feel you talk to them. I mean, my kids will tease me that when they were little, they'd hear me talking to Franklin or Eleanor or Abraham Lincoln in the room. And, you know, because sometimes you're saying, why are you doing that? You shouldn't do that. So obviously the only one I ever got to meet was LBJ, but I feel like I've met the others mainly through the resources that are available from the older days when they kept diaries and they wrote letters. I think it'll be much harder 200 years from now for people to feel that intimacy with the people they'd be writing about now. They'll have so much more stuff about them than we could possibly have had. They'll see how they walked and talked. They'll watch them on video. But people don't write letters in that same way anymore, you know, 10, 20-page letters at night. They're not keeping diaries in the same way. And those are the treasured sources that I've needed to try and bring these people to life.
Doris Kearns Goodwin's latest book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. She and Bill Moyer speak at 6 p.m. Saturday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza as part of an event sponsored by the Truman Library Institute. More information, go to trumanlibraryinstitute.org. Doris, it is always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for taking the time.
You.
Really enjoyed it, Doris.
Time.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.